Ante Up is your poker magazine dedicated to the everyday player and their poker rooms. Pick up a free copy at your favorite poker room nationwide each month. But Ante Up is much more than a magazine. Visit anteupmagazine.com daily for breaking news and each week download our award-winning poker cast. Join us on our action-packed poker cruises to exotic destinations and find special deals on Ante Up gear and great poker products at anteupstore.com. Ante Up. It's your poker magazine.
From the WDAE Sports Animal Studios in Tampa, Florida, it's the Ante Up PokerCast. And now here are two guys who think they know how to play poker, Chris Cosenza and Scott Long.
It's January 6, 2012, and you're listening to the best PokerCast on the planet. I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Long.
Hey, I had a chance to actually go to the horse track, and...
See, you sound like Laura. Laura, whenever we go to the horse track, she's like, what dog are we betting on? And I'm like, you can bet on whatever dog you want. I'm betting on horses.
And, you know, I always go there to play poker, but I never actually went there... Well, I went once a long time ago, but to play the ponies.
See, you were inspired by my story last week, the tear-welling story about... how I remembered how far we've come, and you decided you had to go out there and dump a bunch of money on the horses, right?
I couldn't believe, out of the blue, a couple of Fridays ago, my brother said, hey, you know what? Do they have real horses around here? And I was like, yeah, the real horses everywhere, Tampa Bay Downs, you know?
I can't tell you how much money I lost on the carousel, betting on the carousel.
The fake horses.
Yeah, it's the same damn horse wins every time.
I know, so how could you lose? I don't understand.
Well, the odds are terrible on the favorite.
Oh, man. So I was like, yeah, they're Tampa Bay Downs racing season's going on right now. He's like, what about the three of us, me, you, and Dad, going down and playing one of these days? And I'm like, that sounds like fun. And of course, immediately comes to mind the Everybody Loves Raymond episode, which you probably didn't see. But
no, but I had a feeling there's an Everybody Loves Raymond when you mentioned Dad and brother.
Yeah, and so like the Robert from that show, he has to go to like therapy. And so... The brother, Raymond, and the father have to go with him to this therapy session. And when they get there, they find out the guy is, like, dead or something. So they don't have to go. So now they've got this money for the session that they're supposed to pay, like, $150 each or something. So they're like, well, we got to see. We got a couple $100 between us in an afternoon with nothing to do. So they're like, let's go to the horse track. So they go to the horse track, and they bet, and they win a ton of money. So the first thing I say when we got there, I'm like, all right, so what is this like deep-seated thought that we had buried for years that we had blocked out that we have to tell our spouses, you know, that we've uncovered, you know? So we had a lot of fun with that. But, you know, we get to the track, and, of course, we're totally clueless. You know, we have no idea really what we're doing other than – you know, hey, I think there's a program there. Let's go buy the program and then see what the horses' names are. And
see, you've already disappointed me, Chris. Already disappointed me. I thought what you would do is walk around and look for somebody that dropped their program on the ground.
No.
So you could avoid the $2 charge for the program.
I did that with the pen, though, because we didn't have a pen. Okay. So I waited for some guy to get up and go to the bathroom, then I took the penny left on the table.
Even worse. Outright theft. I love it.
Actually, my dad went and found one somewhere, but we considered stealing a guy's pen. And then finally found a pen. So what I wanted to bring up on the show was that I noticed, like, and my dad is a perfect case study. You know, my dad used to bet – we used to bet Hi-Li a lot when I was younger. I used to go when I couldn't gamble, and then when I was old enough, I'd go and gamble and stuff. But we loved Hi-Li, and my father was like – you know, my father would bet numbers. Now, in Hi-Li, there's sort of a strategy in that, you know, Scott, that when, like, say the one – the way it goes is the one plays the two, and then the winner of that game moves on to play the three, and then so on. So there's sort of a strategy that if you think the one is a better player than two – you might put one in your number picking because you know that he's going to win a point early and then could actually beat, like, the three. And then if he loses to the four, then the four wins a couple, then loses to the seven. Then the seven gets back to the one, and then the one wins. Now you've got one, four, and seven have the points. And so it makes sense to try to do a box with those three numbers. So in a way, there's a little strategy in Hi-Li. Of course, you look at, you know, how well they've performed over the last 10 games and who they are and stuff like that. So
whether they're on a take or not. You know,
yeah, who's eating more donuts that week? But really, for the most part, you could probably get away with just playing numbers and just having a good time and not risking too much money. But when you're playing horses, to me, I consider horse betting to have a lot of skill. I don't, and I think that's one of the reasons why it's like these carve outs, you know, where you can bet on horses online or whatever it is, because there is a skill to reading the program, to learning about the horses, about the conditions or whatever. So immediately my poker senses took over when I got there, and I started reading the program, looking at the favorites, looking at how fast they've run that particular length of track that they were going to run in that one race. So I started making calculated guesses and stuff, and I always made sure I had the favorite in my trifecta, and then I would pick the other two horses that I thought, based on the information I could read about and whatever, right, I would make my bet. So I would say to my dad, all right, I'm playing 2-3-4 today, and the reason why is, and I, whatever. And my father says, well, I like the number 8. So I'm like, oh, the number 8 horse? He goes, no, the number 8. So I'm like, what? He goes, yeah, I like the number 8, so I'm gonna play 3-8. So I'm like, okay, well, did you know that 8 is a 30-1 underdog? That's okay, I like the 8. Okay, so what it reminded me of is when we're at home and I play in the home game with my dad, it's the same mentality. He thinks that every single hand is just luck. It's based on whoever got the best cards on that hand, and that's all that's going to happen in this. It's not going to be, you know, any skill or any thought process or any calculating of odds or anything like that. He just thinks, hey, there's a king on the board. I have a king in my hand. Who cares that the kicker is a 3 in my hand? I'm going to play this one all the way to the end and not fold because I have a pair of kings, not realizing that the likelihood of me raising him means I have king ace in my hand or whatever.
Right.
And I couldn't believe how consistent people are. Yeah. When it comes to gaming, and I don't really know where I'm going with this, but the fact of the matter is that I mean, I won 3 out of 6 races and won a lot of money, and matter of fact, those 3 races were trifectas. I picked the 3 horses that won out of 6 races, and my dad and my brother all didn't win 1 race, not 1, and they lost all their the money. They not all the money. It's hard to lose a lot of money if you're playing conservatively. But they both didn't even win a race, and I won 3 out of 6, and it was because I carefully thought about it. And when they bet, they just had a feeling about the name of the horse, or they had a, you know what I mean, that stupid stuff that you see like on Everybody Loves Raymond when one of them had a name of a horse that reminded them of their mother or something, so they played it. And it was like, that is like the silliest thing to do. I like to play long shots occasionally because if they come in, it's a big payout, but I would rather win a little bit. And this goes back to our poker stuff too. I brought up that topic a long time ago about, hey, if you could play all night with your friends and only win $2, but know you're going to win every single time you play, would you keep doing it?
Right.
You know, and it's the same kind of thing here. I had a lot of fun. Tampa Bay Downs is a great place. The day was nice. It was crisp. It was sunny. And it was more about being with my brother and my father than about anything. But I didn't want to sit there and just throw away $60 if I stayed for all 10 races and bet a $6, you know, exacta or a $9 trifecta or whatever. So anyway, I ended up winning a decent amount of money, and my brother and my father didn't. And it was amazing how they don't think of it as strategy at all. They only thought of it as, I like these numbers.
Well, I'll give you another example, and we can sign our dads and you and me up for group therapy here at some point. Because, you know, every year I do a little Kentucky – bet the Kentucky Derby, you know, Laura and one of my old coworkers, we all pick a dog, as Laura likes to say, and we create a trifecta, and, you know, we're just hoping for the big score. But so I go off the track to bet it, and my dad always calls me, like, hey, Scott, you going to the track? Good. Could you put some money down for me? Sure, Dad. What do you want? And he always ends up betting the favorite to show.
Oh, yeah.
And I keep telling him, like, Dad, you're going to win 20 cents doing that. And you're risking the fact that it might not happen. So you're risking $2 when you know you're only going to get 20 cents back if it hits. And the fact that it might not hit and you end up losing money. It's just not a good way to bet that. Oh, I don't care. I'm going to win. And so, and of course, you know, I bet what I do. I bet what he does. And I lose. And he's like, oh, I'll show you. I'm like, no, Dad, I showed you because you're going to have to drive this ticket over the track and cash it in yourself because I'm not wasting the gas to go over there and collect your 20 cents for you. Oh, man, that sucks. Yeah, well, Dad, you got to learn. But, you know, to a poker thing, though, that's the same way. To me, that's the parallel to trying to win pots versus winning money.
Right.
You know, for him, he just wants to win.
Right.
All right, that's great. In poker, I know a lot of players that are like, you know, hey, I won that pot. That's great. Okay, that's great. Yeah, sure. I mean, it's better to win a pot than lose a pot. I'm not going to argue that. But did you get as much money out of that pot as you could have? If not, you really lost. And you may not have lost a lot, but you lost something. So you're always looking for value. So I guess that's the parallel I see in my family is Dad's just interested in winning rather than winning as much money. So you know, even though maybe I lost my $2 bet and didn't get anything to show for it, I probably had a better shot at extracting more value out of that bet than he did.
Exactly. And I think I hit home with my dad toward the end, because again he brought up something about I just like 3-8 or something, and I'm like, yeah. Dad, you're thinking about high lie when the 3 could win all the way till the 8 and then the 8 could win out and then he's going to have a 3-8 1-8-3 or something sort of trifecta. I said, but let's look at it this way. You like the 8, right? And he said, yeah. And I said, and you like 3, right? He said, yeah. I said, okay, well, what if I told you that 1, 2, 4, 5, 6, 7 were cheetahs, and 3 and 8 were donkeys. Would you still bet 3-8 because you like the numbers? And he said, no. I said, well, you're doing that right now. Look at the sheet. This yeah. horse has never run this race any faster than 147, ever. And the other ones are all in 142 land, and they're yeah. the favorites. Why would you want to bet a horse? I mean, it's possible that maybe he could do it or whatever. But and then he kind of looked at me like, huh. And then I think he actually like changed his mind and tried to make a more calculated bet, but he couldn't really let go of the numbers. But really, that's yeah. the best way to do it. Like, and even in High Lie, you know, there was a player named Bolivar that anybody who follows High Lie will know him. Even our yeah. good friend Marty over at Dania High Lie, of course, knew who he was. He was a legend. He's like the greatest player ever. And I wanted to say to my dad, Dad, if 8 was Bolivar and you're watching High Lie, yeah, you want to play again, you know, have Bolivar on your card. But if Bolivar is 1 and Inclon is 2 and, you know, Jabot is 3 and Chris Cosenza is 8, just you don't play 8. I mean, you just don't do it. And it's just – it's a skill. And it was surprising to see them lose all their money and not adjust. They just went with the, you know, the numbers they liked or the names they liked or something. And then I think at the end they started to think differently and got closer to winning. Like two other numbers would come in. But they would be second and third, and they were playing like an exacta for first and second or whatever. So, but yeah, I couldn't believe it. I realize I can't believe we've talked like 15 minutes about this. I didn't think we would. But it's just remarkable how people don't change no matter what it is they do with gaming. You know what I mean? If there was a skill with blackjack, they would just keep hit to try to get close to 21 no matter what, instead of realizing that the dealer has a 5 showing and he's going to have to hit, you know, whatever it is, 7 or whatever, you know, and have to hit. And he's going to likely bust because why would you hit your cards when you don't have to? But they still want to try to get to 21. You know, it's just yeah, there's no skill.
Well, you know, I think you're right. Everybody has a gambling personality. And, I mean, in some cases, there's a split personality. And that seems to be the buzz this week about Phil Ivey. that he has one personality on Full Tilt and perhaps a different personality on Poker Stars. And I don't know if you saw this, but I thought this was a little funny, and you know, apparently there's a group of players now that are piecing together bits of information and are claiming that the player called Raise Once on PokerStars is really Phil Ivey.
Wow.
Now, of course, it's all rumors now, and we try not to engage in rumors here on Ante Up. But the reason I brought it up is the one story I read about it. Let me try to find the list of how they figured this out here.
So I'll fill the time.
Sorry.
Go ahead, keep going.
All right, so this is what this one website said that people put together. They said that Reyes once lives in Mexico, where Phil Ivey is known to have a home.
Hmm.
All right?
Yeah.
But the similarities don't end there. they noticed that when Ivey became disconnected on Full Tilt Poker, that was the same time that Reyes once appeared on PokerStars. Similarities in playing style, number of simultaneous tables played, text language used, stopping play during losing sessions, and playing in limited tournaments with only the highest of buy-ins are all reasons why poker fans believe that this is Phil Ivey. So this is people can check out what I'm reading at Poker News Report. I don't really care whether Phil Ivey's raised once or not, and it's not what we're talking about. But what I want to talk about is, who are these people to have this much time to do all this investigation? Now, I know people listen to another, hey, isn't that Andy Up's job? Shouldn't you be out there investigating? Well, yeah, sure, we should be investigating stuff. I don't know whether we need to waste our time trying to figure out whether Ray's once is Phil Ivey. I mean, it's kind of a novelty. If it is, it's kind of cool. But obviously, there are people out there that have enough time that they're sitting away, you know what? Hey, I noticed that guy plays just like this guy.
I tell you, if I had that kind of time, man, I obviously would be well off in life and not have a job, because I mean, there's just no way that you can do that and still. I wonder what kind of people they are. Are they people who play poker for a living and have all this time on their hands? I mean, it's just remarkable.
Well, you know, I give them credit because it obviously takes some good observation skills to even put one and one together here, let alone two and two. And, you know, if you got that kind of observation skills, you're probably really good at poker, probably really good at stud eight. So, you know, I'm not knocking them at all. But, you know, to me, it's a difference here between piecing together the dots on the puzzle and finding out that there were accounts on Ultimate Bet that super user accounts. You know, that was probably the most amazing investigative poker stuff ever, and it'll probably be hard to top that. Whether Phil Ivey's playing on PokerStars doesn't seem quite worth the same amount of effort.
No, exactly, because the payoff, who cares? I mean, ultimately, the payoff doesn't mean anything. With Ultimate Bet, that was huge. People were being robbed. You know, it was the ends justified the means. You know, I mean, who cares? You know, I mean, I do people do that with Batman and Bruce Wayne? You know what I mean?
Maybe we wouldn't have so many movies.
Exactly. So I don't know. Just seems funny when somebody says I'm Batman that they don't do that kind of investigative journalism, but they do when it's Phil Ivey on PokerStars.
Yeah. All right. Well, I said at the top of this that we're not going to take the bait and talk about it too much, but you did mention who cares, and I guess that's the last question here before we move on to something else. Does anybody really care whether Ivy is playing on PokerStars? And it's a legitimate question. I'm not sure that sounds loaded, but I don't mean to make loaded. It's a legitimate question. You know, obviously he's not going to be playing on Full Tilt ever again. He sued him. You know, and, right. So he's a poker player. He's going to play online if he's able to live in a different country. Why not play on PokerStars? Should we be shocked at all that any of these players that were previously with Full Tilt or popping up on other sites?
Definitely not. I think that we're finding out more and more about the Full Tilt thing, and that Ivy wasn't as much of a player with Full Tilt as we thought. That as far as integral in the brass, not as in playing online. And so that, given plus the stand he took against them, the lawsuit, everything else, sure, if he wants to play online poker, of course he's going to play on Stars. It's the best site that's left, and it's the biggest site that's left still. Why wouldn't he? You know?
But even if he was more involved, which, you know, there's still some debate how much he was. I mean, you know, Howard Leonard is probably the wrong example to bring up here, but it's not shocking to me that somebody's going to move to another site and play with it. You know, hey, you know, if something terrible happens to Andy Up and we have to close it down, you know, I don't think it should be shocking if I end up writing for another poker magazine or you co-host another podcast or something. I mean, that's what we do. That's what's in our blood. So, you know, there's loyalty while it's still around, but once it's gone, then, you know, you just can become a hermit crab.
Well, the other thing, too, is think about it from a brick-and-mortar standpoint. You know, a good example would be Brendan Lee, right? He's Foxwoods guy. He's not going to only just play at Foxwoods. He makes a living as a poker player. He's going to follow the tour. He's going to play in other places. Yep. So if there's a different game that they offer on Stars or a different group of players that he felt like he can beat, sure, it's just playing poker. It's not that he's not going to be devoted to whatever site he's affiliated with at the time, but, you know, there's still opportunities out there in the poker world. That's why it's a poker game. It can happen anywhere, so why not on PokerStars? So, yeah, I'm not shocked at all, especially, though, given all the other stuff that happened. But, yeah, I'm not shocked at all. Why not?
All right, and then the final thing I got to say, if your sign-on name is Raise Once and you two-bet me, I have a problem with that.
Yeah, that I have a problem with.
That's just not cool. That's false advertising.
Yeah, when you have a sign that says never fold, and then I have the nuts and you fold, I have a problem with that.
It's just not right.
That's right.
But I tell you what is right. We are writing. I wouldn't say it wrong, but we're trying to improve it here. We've got a number of requests to not be so hardline with our swag policy on this great award-winning Annie Up PokerCast. And it's a new year, turning over a new leaf, and we're happy to let people know that we're changing the policy here now, that the hardcore one swag and you're done rule is gone. And from here on out, it's going to be one piece of swag per year.
Yeah.
All right, so if your last one, your swag 2 years ago, you're back in the running. Send us your emails, your hands of the week, call the hotline, and you've got another prize coming to you. And once you're on the show, then, you know, hey, keep sending us stuff. But no, you're not going to be able to pile up swag until 1 year from the time it's on.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it makes sense, too, because, I mean, let's say you started listening to the show in 06 or 07, and we were giving out, you know, Pabst Blue Ribbon empties from Scott's Christmas tree.
That's a quality gift.
And then you won that, and Scott says, okay, well, you won that, so now you can't win the J-Design playing cards. I mean, right. You know, you're kind of ripping. So we don't want to do that. We don't want to shut you out anymore. We still have to keep some sort of tabs on it and some sort of records. And, you know, there might be some brilliant listener out there who comes up with all this great stuff for us, and he would kill our swag shelf. So we need to have it once a year. But at least now you're back in the running again, and then once you win this year, next year you might have even better products that you can win again. So that, it's a great idea, Scott.
And there's more! If you order right now, we're going to try to freshen up the offerings, or at least rotate them a little bit more, and we're real excited about this. Starting with next week's show, we're going to be giving away once a week a Chinese 13-card poker app for Apple products, you know, the iPads, iPhones, iPod Touches. And we're going to have the developers of that that app on the show in the main topic today when we talk about Chinese poker. It's a great game, and we're going to have a lot of fun talking about it. But we're going to be giving away one of those each week. And, you know, we started this call to floor thing. I don't know when we started. About a year ago,
Maybe almost a year ago, yeah.
And every once in a while, I started realizing, you know, hey, readers are submitting this stuff, and we're using it. And, you know, we're not giving any swag out for that. So we're going to change that now with the Chinese 13-card poker app coming on. So now the call to floor winners are also going to be getting swag. So four wonderful swag opportunities each week. Man. And you only have to wait a year to get another one.
Okay, well, our hotline is 813-448-1120. And guess what? Nobody called. They all got too drunk. They're all hungover from New Year's. No one called us on the first show of the year.
Well, they're just worried that they weren't going to get any swag. So, you know, now it's going to be ringing off the hook. It's going to be like the Jerry Lewis Telethon here this week.
Well, if you had called, you would have won a T-shirt from PMS Pokerware, which sells hilarious shirts for gals and guys in the Annie Up Store at AnnieUpStore.com.
Well, we did get a mailbag, and it came from Bill Galantine, and I don't know how to pronounce it, but one of the quality beers out there is Ballantine, and it's spelled the same way. So.
Yeah, and Valentine is coming up, Valentine's Day. So I'm pretty sure you got it on the head there.
It could be Galantini, but I don't care. I'm going to call it Ballantine. So, Bill Galantine, and I love this question. This is the one that I think a lot of listeners have probably broached at some point, and maybe not have written in to ask us. So, here's what he had to write. He said, every month, my friends and I play Hold'em. Never for money. He says, but now about five of us are going to play a real cash game, tournament style, just to see what it's like. My concern is I'm in charge of it, and I'm trying to make up a set of rules. Since it's a money game, I don't want people to argue about a lot of stuff. One of the rules I have is no folding or betting before your turn, or you forfeit the hand. Does this seem like a good rule? I just wonder about his close friends arguing. Do you have experience with good friends playing for cash? Good idea? I want to start playing for money against people I don't know in casinos, but I'm using this as a test to see how it goes and how I play. So he's throwing a lot at us, so let's start off by saying, first, let's talk about the rule that he put out there. And if you act out of turn, boom, your hand's gone.
Okay, now one of the things that I emailed him about was he said he wanted to set the rules and he wanted to feel like what he would encounter in a casino and make them legitimate rules. And to me, this is not a legitimate rule. This is something that's only going to cause problems. Why? Because there are legitimate reasons for people to bet out of turn because they did it by accident. And so in a casino, you would not have to be forced to fold your hand. You would be warned. You would be warned again, and then you'd be penalized. But you would not be forced to forfeit your hand. It's very, very harsh to me. So when he asks, does it seem like a good rule? No, I don't think it's a good rule at all. I think that you might want to alert these guys that you want to take it seriously and that they shouldn't do that. And that's a huge thing. And if they do it, if you're in a tournament setting and they do it after two or three times, maybe say, look, you need to stop, or maybe we should have a sit-out rule. If they all agree to it, that's one thing. But to forfeit the hand, you're not really practicing any kind of real casino rule there.
Well, yeah, and I agree that you should. I mean, you should be trying to replicate the casino experience as much as possible. But I get the spirit of it, and you know, when I coached T-ball, I used to have a rule where when the kid threw the bat, they were out.
Yeah.
And I used to have a parent all chewing at me because this guy hit like a triple, and I walked over and tapped him on the shoulder, and he knew what he did, and he sat on the bench. Like, what are you doing, coach? And I'm like, hey, threw the bat. They're like, arr! I'm like, you know, but I'm just trying to teach the kid that, you know, you can't throw the bat. And this is, it's drastic, but it works. So, you know, if you have to be drastic to make it work, that's fine. But I think you can find a way to enforce that differently without being that drastic, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Of course, now I take umbrage with you in the coaching thing. Because, I mean, really, you could just put a runner in for the kid and don't damage the team and make the kid sit out the game.
T-ball, we don't keep scoring T-ball.
There was no score in T-ball?
No. You can't crush the kid's hopes and dreams until they move up to single A.
Oh, okay, then he's out.
Yeah.
Okay, that's fine. I thought you were damaging the team there. If you're not hurting the team, then, yeah, kick his butt out.
All right, so this next question, and this is a real serious one, I think. He's worried and wondering about close friends arguing. I mean, right now they're playing for fun. They're having a good time. They're yucking it up. They're having past blue ribbons, and it's a good thing. And then all of a sudden you introduce money, and things change, right?
Yeah, he says, do you have experience with good friends playing for cash? No, I have no good friends when I play. The guys I play against are not good friends. They're just I see them as big ATMs. No, obviously we do. We have a lot of experience playing. We've gotten pretty tight. I think when we first started, we were sort of acquaintances and stuff, and then some of them were podcast listeners. But I think we're all pretty good friends now. And the game has, I think, gotten a little more friendly than it used to be. And I think that that's just a product of just because we're friends. And we understand the rules of poker. We understand what's expected of us. And we want a really good poker experience that night. But if somebody checks out a turn or something like that, you know, or whatever, no, we pretty much look the other way. But we might bust their chops a little bit about it and things like that, and that'll be the punishment. But really, I think we do have a lot of experience now playing for cash with friends, and I don't think we've really had a couple of times somebody will throw a card down because they got frustrated or something, but there's no real fights between people. And it's how good the friendship is, I think, that helps dictate that.
Yeah, and I think Bill's in a great situation. He's got a group of players that they've been playing with together for a while, it sounds like.
Right.
So at that point, you can sit down and just have a discussion. Maybe you don't even play that night. Maybe you just say, hey, let's go to Beef O'Brady's tonight, get a pitcher of beer, let's talk about this, and you have a good chat and say, hey, I'm a little concerned. You know, I love you guys, and I want to play for money, and I think you guys want to play for money. Let's just not let it harm the friendship. And you can start off with that discussion where, I mean, it was a little more difficult for us because our game kind of developed over time. I mean, we started with money and different people came in. So I think you can do that. I guess my other advice too is just to remind everyone, you know, that when money's involved, it does. Sometimes things get a little heated. So you just got to remember to turn the threat level up to orange and be a little guarded and know that, you know, the stuff can happen. And I think more it's how you deal with it after it happens rather than trying to prevent it up front. Because, you know, you can try all you want to prevent stuff, but there's going to be a situation where someone just gets ticked off at someone.
Absolutely.
You know, and they lose a lot of money, and it's not personal necessarily, but it hurts. You know, hey, maybe they're playing on, you know, buying an iPod so they could play Chinese 13-card poker app that they just won on the Annie of PokerCast, and boom, now they just lost on a two-outer, you know. They're going to get upset. That doesn't mean they're upset at you, the player, necessarily. It just means they're upset. So you just got to kind of take a grain of salt a little bit, I think.
And the other thing, too, is I don't know if we do this consciously or not, but maybe you should consider that the limits that you set on this game are much cheaper than what you'll encounter at a casino. Like, maybe make it a 25-cent, 50-cent game or something. Because we do that in our game. I think that you would much rather play a 4-8 game than the 2-4 game that we play. but it's our friends, and we don't want anybody to get too damaged in a home game. Like even Gambit's home game is like 1-2. It's not even 2-4.
Right.
But you know, we would. I think that you and I, when we play in the casino, if we're playing limit games, we want to play 4-8 or even 5-10, maybe 3-6. But we don't ever play 2-4 when we're in a casino, even if it's available ever. So that's one way to avoid friends being ticked off at each other, is make it so that even if they did lose, it's really not that big of a deal. It's just it's you're getting used to the fact of what it's like to put to decisions. So when you do go to the casino, you're playing for money.
Yeah, I think the bottom line, always remember, is when I'm playing in a home game, and I think there should be a home game with everyone, I'm playing for the social aspect. I'm there to have fun with friends. I would not enjoy it going there and playing for, I need to have something to get my blood juiced a little bit, but I don't need it to be nosebleed stakes either. So you just remember, you're there to have fun, and you're slowly progressing, so you learn how to play for money and how that changes your decision, so you can go into that casino and play with strangers, and I think you're fine. You just got to remember that.
It's pretty remarkable, too, when we're playing, and we're playing limit game after limit game after limit game, and we're all yucking it up and joking, and then finally the guy who's stuck after 2 hours finally says, all right, let's play No Limit. All of a sudden it gets totally quiet and serious, and people fold a million. You know, it's just remarkable how different it is. So there really is a difference when you're playing for bigger stakes. So just consider the stakes you play for.
All right, Bill, we're going to help you get off onto the right foot here by sending you a deck of J-Design playing cards, the official playing cards of Anti-Up. You can pick up your own decks at the Anti-Up store at antiupstore.com. And remember to email your mailbag questions to us at podcast@antiupmagazine.com. That's the same address to send your hands of the week and also your call the floor questions.
Please don't mail us your e-bags. I don't want any e-bags coming to our... All right, so speaking of Call to Four, Eric Invest Pro Rollins sends
in a little nickname. I like that.
Yeah, I like the nickname. Sends in a little something for our Call to Four segment, and we're on the hook here. We're going to do it ourselves. Jody's a little busy not answering our phone calls, so we'll get this to ourselves here. Playing in a home game, three players go into the river. The action goes check, check. Then the river card is exposed as the dealer forgot about the third player. What's the next course of action, Scott?
All right. Without Jody to back me up here, I'm fairly confident that what happens here is that the players are informed that river card will not be the river card, and that the action is completed. So the player that did not get to act, a third player there, will be able to act knowing that that river card will not be the river card. After the action is done, the river card is returned to the stub. The stub is shuffled, and a new river card is put out. And the hope is that that same card comes out, because that was the legitimate card. And sometimes it does happen, but it doesn't. But it gives that card a chance to come back out. But obviously, it could be any other card in the deck. So that's how I've always seen it done.
Me too. I can see where they might think there's some other kind of ruling where, okay, that's going to be the river, but there's no more betting on that round, and the third person doesn't get his chance to bet. But that's not fair, because if he knew that card was going to be the river, then it might help his hand. He knows he can bet now. So there's no way that person should be privy to that knowledge, and the other two weren't, and forced to make their action without knowing the river. So it has to go back into the deck and shuffle.
Well, and I think it's important to understand that there's it's a tough situation regardless. I mean, there's no way to really make this perfect unless you have one of those little flashy stick things from Men in Black, and everybody forgets the card. But this is the most fair way to do it, because it gives it opportunity for that card to come back, but you also can't have that third player not get to act, and you can't get him the option to act after he's got more information than the other two people in the hand.
Right, exactly.
Act. So, you know, this is what happens in humans are make mistakes. So, you know, you do the best you can with it. All right, Eric, we're going to send you, remember, your first Call to Four swag winner. Round of applause.
Yay!
We will send you a download to the Poker Hand Breakdown Pro, a hand history analysis program for single or mixed games. That comes from the good folks at element26.net. That's element numeral 2, numeral 6.net.
Did we give Bill his swag? I can't remember.
We did. Remember, we started him off right with that deck of J-Design playing cards.
Okay, very good. You know, I'm floating in and out here. I'm so excited about today's main topic. I forget. Okay, well, we did get some feedback, too, from Button Girl in Wales. I always love it when our responses come from across the pond.
Absolutely. It
says, I was entertained to hear you joke about Usain Bolt advertising KFC as Bolt ran his Beijing 100 meter fueled by chicken nuggets. So I guess KFC is just putting its money where his mouth is.
Yeah, I totally apologize for not doing research and just thinking that it was crazy that he would be advertising chicken. But yeah, he apparently chowed down the chicken nuggets. And, you know, she sent us a link to a video where Michael Johnson, one of the greatest Olympians of all time, was interviewing him. And they were talking about the fact that he eats the chicken nuggets and how people think that's weird, like obviously I did. But they don't understand the fact that when you are as physically fit as they are and working out, you can pretty much eat whatever you want because your body's going to chew it up and spit it out, you know, as long as it's balanced. And as soon as I watched that, I remembered, you know, all the hullabaloo over Michael Phelps.
Yep, Phelps.
You know, where he had like, what, 40,000 calories a day. And people were like, oh, my gosh. But, you know, the guy worked him off. So.
Yeah, and Armstrong, too, with all his Tour de France or whatever, he would eat like 12,000 calories a day or something or whatever it was. So, oh, you think that if I don't know, you think if Jamie Gold ran the 100 meters, he'd eat blueberries before he raced?
Probably would. And he'd probably run faster because he'd have to get to the bathroom right after he got 100 meters to avoid some embarrassment.
The only thing that goes faster than Usain Bolt is blueberries through his colon.
Well, Bud Girl, I certainly appreciate you setting me straight there. I do not pretend to be a nutritionist, and I will quit pretending. But I will continue to say I think it's funny that Olympians are eating fried chicken.
Absolutely.
Regardless.
Absolutely.
All right, we got some housekeeping to take care of. We keep putting the show off, but we're going to get to it eventually, and it just gives our listeners more time to be part of it. In a couple weeks, we'll be doing our show on who we think are the top five most famous poker players now. And if you haven't thought about it, think about it, and you'll find out how difficult that might be. But email us your list at podcast@antiupmagazine.com or post it in our form at antiupmagazine.com/form. And we're going to devote the show to it here in the coming weeks, we promise.
Yeah, the more I think about it, the more I'm going on the other side of the square frame that is the box.
Ooh, excellent.
I'm really starting to really think about it as an overall thing. So I don't know. I may have like five lists for you when the show comes, or I may just have one. I don't know, but we'll see. Don't forget that our cruise schedule for 2012 is set. It's very exciting. We've got one coming up pretty soon already, actually. Out of Tampa, March 17th. Going to go to Costa Maya and Cozumel. That's pretty good. And then we're going August 27th out of Port Canaveral and November 10th out of Baltimore. We've got people already booking for Baltimore. That's awesome. Almost a year away, so we're pretty excited. Go to antiupmagazine.com/cruise for all the great details, and we'll hope to see you in Tampa.
Yeah, if you want to join us on Tampa, remember the rate guarantee deadline is January 10th, so by this time next week, you will miss the rate guarantee, and I cannot guarantee the price. I can't even guarantee I can get you on the ship then. So if you're on the fence about coming, you better get off the fence here in the next couple of days.
All right, Scott, do we have an Antiup news desk?
Well, you know, I looked around, Chris, and I couldn't find it. I don't know if I misplaced it or something, but... You know, here's the thing that, you know, we've been in the news business a long time, right? And the old adage there is, wow, nothing ever seems to happen over the holidays, which I always get a chuckle out of.
Yeah.
Because stuff is happening all the time. It's just when reporters aren't there to hear it, no one knows about it. So here's the real thing is journalists take this week off between Christmas and New Year's just like everybody else. So I'm sure there's a lot of poker news out there. But we were all enjoying our Christmas hams and our eggnogs and our getting drunk on New Year's Eve. And there just wasn't any news to report this week. So we'll let it cure from its hangover and come back fresh next week with a lot of real insightful news because journalists are going to be well-rested in writing a lot of stuff this week, I imagine.
Yeah, because we don't have to keep resorting to rumors about PokerStars players. All right, we get to finish up an O'Malley's move today. Let's listen to part one again, and then we'll come back with our thoughts.
Hello, and welcome to another O'Malley's Move. I'm Malcolm O'Malley. This week, we're at your run-of-the-mill, garden-variety, $1, $2, no-limit hold'em cash game with 9 players seated. The table we're at is pretty loose, but fairly passive pre-flop. Most of the action comes on the flop. There are, however, 2 or 3 significant threats at the table. We're up 100 with 300 to our name. Blinds post, under the gun calls, and it goes fold, 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 fold to us in the cutoff with ace 10 of clubs. The limper is one of the significant threats, as is the button that is behind us. Since the under the gun just limped in and is a very tricky player, he could have anything from suited connectors to pocket rockets. We've got to define his hand. We make the table standard 6x big blind raise, but also account for the limper. Our bet is $14. The player behind us, the other threat, has over 500. He's a solid player who may be a bit on the tight side, but has worked his stack up nicely. He too bought in for 200. He makes the call, the blinds fold, and the under the gun calls as well, with a basic mirror image stack as us. The pot is $45, and the flop comes 4 of spades, 3 of clubs, deuce of hearts. We virtually missed that completely. A 5 gives us a straight, but toward the ignorant end. But the under-the-gun player checks to us. We figure we've got to make our standard C-bet, since we were the pre-flop aggressor. With $45 in the pot, and thankfully some savvy opponents, we can play some actual poker. Be aggressive while exercising pot control at the same time. We make it $25 to go, just over half pot, leaving us about $270. The button calls time and thinks for a while before making the call, and the under the gun mucks. The pot is nearing 100 as the turn is the 7 of clubs. This isn't a terrible card for us as it adds the nut flush draw. And we remember hearing somewhere that you're always supposed to bet the turn. We're going to fire round number 2 at this pot, still trying to exercise what's left of our pot control strategy. We make it $50 to go, leaving us about $210. Once again, our opponent calls time, thinks for a while, and then calls our bet. What could he have? The pot is at 195 as the river is the king of diamonds. So the action's on us, and we've got ace high. Do we have what it takes to fire that third round? And if so, is that even the best move?
All right, I have to admit here, I'm a little flummoxed on this one. In the 1-2 games that I play, a player calling time twice and merely calling is one that's got a small piece of the board or on a draw. But for me, it's hard to imagine that's the case here since we raised a $14 preflop. So what kind of hands would call that? I don't think that fits into that hand range there. A small pair is possible too, but O'Malley says our opponent is sharp. It's been described as sharp. So if you're sharp, it's hard to imagine playing this hand this way with a pair. So to be honest, I really don't know what we're up against here, and I think it's risky to bet into a black hole on the river. If I was going to bet, it would probably be $100, and I don't think it's worth it to me to put that $100 bet in here to find out what we're up against. So I'm going to check, I'm going to hope for a free showdown, and if he makes a fishy steal attempt, I might consider calling, but this one's a situation. We're out of a position, and this is what happens when you're out of position.
Well, it's interesting that you said you brought up the sharp part and how you wouldn't play it that way. Before I say what I want to say is what were you thinking differently about if they had their own pair or whatever? Like, what would he play differently?
I don't know whether he would have hesitated and called time and then just called us with a pair. I think, if I've got fives on up here, I'm going to try to figure out – I've got position. I'm going to try to – put a little pressure on you. Try to figure out what you have, and if you don't have anything, get you to fold. And maybe I'm wrong, but if I had fives or higher or set or anything like that here, I'm going to put on a bet here. I mean, I'm going to raise you a little bit and find out, whether you really have it or not.
Okay.
Because I can throw that pair away pretty easily if I raise you and you re-raise me back, because then I know you've got something better than I do.
I kind of took the time thing as a real decision. I don't think he's Hollywooding. Since we said he was sharp, then I would say if he is a sharp player, then I feel like he's got this trying to get a read on us thing by calling time. And, if he's got sixes, but he's wondering because we raised preflop, do you have tens? He's still not good. So he's wondering, is this worth a call? Is this worth a call? And then when the 7 comes, you don't put him on a 7, so you're thinking I-6s might still be good if he has ace-king. So I just felt like he was kind of trying to get a read on us. And to me, it kind of makes sense, 6s or 8s, the way the story's going, if you're thinking that way, trying to get a read on us.
Because right, here's the thing, pair. And I totally meant as I meant, I'm flummoxed on this hand. So,
right.
But I guess my... if I have 6s there, I'm going to call time because I'm worried about you having 10s. I'm just going to keep calling and putting more money into this pot.
I think
I'd want to find out now, you know, whether my 6s are good or not, right?
I don't know. I think that he might be looking at that $25 bet as, okay, that's a decent amount to bet, but it seems like a C bet, but I'm going to call here and float him on the turn and see what he does on the turn. And then when he bets 50, maybe he's thinking that, you know, maybe he does or he doesn't. That's why he calls time. And then I just feel like it's, yeah, do you want to, when he bets 50 now, are you really going to make it 150 to find out if your hand is good? Why not bet
and
call the 50?
Well, no, I would have done it on the flop. I mean, I wouldn't have done the whole float thing. But but I guess my point is, if I mean, we could have a wide range of hands here as well, too. But if we're thinking, I'm worried that he has 10s, I'm not sure I want to keep just pumping money into this pot to find out whether I'm right or not. I'm in a position, you have the ability when you're in position to get some answers that you don't have when you're out of position.
Well, here's what I think when it comes to this situation that we're facing here. Let's say we did what you said, and O'Malley bets 25, and we raise. Well, we're generally going to make it 75. Well, if we don't make it 75 and we call, the likelihood of him betting more than 50 in a turn isn't much. So I would think that we've just gotten to see the turn, and for the same price, called again. And when you go to the river, if you don't think that he's going to bet, you know, if you think he can steal the river or whatever it is, he might check it down because he fired at it twice. I don't know. I feel like the $75 that he invested, he got to see the turn for the same price. Because then if you get pushed off the hand after you bet 75 on the flop, now you got to fold. And you have an overpair to the board, and you don't like to fold an overpair of the board if you had 6s or 8s or 9s or whatever. So it wasn't necessarily 10s that I was just saying. I just think this guy is really trying to get a read on us on whether or not he legitimately has a bigger pair than us or if he's just trying to push us off with ace-king. That's why I felt like he was calling time, because what other reason is he calling time for? Is he really calling time with a draw after that 7? Why?
Well, yeah, that's what I said. That's where I'm flummoxed, because any draw cards just don't make sense here, because the flop, you have no flush possibilities at all, you know, unless you had, like, I don't know, ace four of clubs, which still doesn't make sense. You know, then you picked up a flush draw there. I mean, obviously you could pick up a straight draw there, but that doesn't make sense either, you know, unless you have 6s or 5s,
right?
You know, maybe pocket 5s, that makes sense, because then you got the pair plus the
open draw,
but I don't know, it seems weird to me that the hands that would call the $14 pre-flop would be draw here.
Well, I could go either way on this, and I believe in my heart that this guy actually has a made hand already. It's just that's how I feel. And if I think that he has a hand like that, I can bet comfortably thinking he'll fold if I'm repping ace king or aces. But if this guy's a calling station and that's what we're up against, then I think I'm going to check and hope he's scared of the king and checks too, and we get to see his hand.
So
that's what I'm thinking. If I feel like this guy just isn't going to go anywhere, then obviously I'm not going to bet. But I'm not sure what's going to happen here. So let's hear part two.
Hello again. So what are we doing here? As we replay the hand back in our mind, we realize we could be in an uncomfortable situation. We raised preflop, bet $25 on the flop, then $50 on the turn. So we've only put in $89. But that's almost a third of our entire stack. Meanwhile, our opponent, who's generally a fairly solid player, has all of a sudden turned into a calling station. So let's start with his actions and try to paint a clear picture. He called our raise preflop, but it was from the button. So even though he's solid, he doesn't have to have a monster. He could have something like ace-x suited, any pocket pair really, ace-king, potentially, though we've seen him re-raise preflop with Big Slick already tonight. It could be ace-queen or king-queen. Ace-jack is possible. Wow, that's a lot of hands. So we're going to need to analyze his post-flop behavior. He just called our bet on the flop, which might eliminate the mid to high pocket pairs. Jacks, tens, maybe even nines. So it's possible he has something like fives through eights, ace-king, ace-queen, ace-jack, or king-queen. But let's eliminate ace-king. When he once again just called our bet on the turn, I think it's safe to eliminate 7-7. And he might have even folded the hands where he just had two overcards, unless he has us on rubbish as well. His range is narrowing, but we'll leave the overs in to err on the side of caution. So once again, that's ace-queen, ace-jack, king-queen, eights, sixes, and fives. The only hand we're really concerned about would be king-queen. We could probably get him to fold any of the others. Let's evaluate what he may think we have. We raised pre, bet post, and on the turn, perhaps with overs, which is true, just not as strong of overs as he may expect. Is it possible we represented something like ace-king, king-queen, or king-jack? Well, as is sometimes the situation in No Limit Hold'em, you just have to do a gut check and make the aggressive stand. We're going to bet here. With the pot at 195, we kind of want to make it look like we want a call, but we don't want to make it so low that it prices him in with some mid-pocket pair. We decide 125 is perfect, and we carefully count out that amount and put it in the middle. This only leaves us with 86, but we're hoping he'll take that as a clue that we are ready and willing to put the rest of it in. He lets out an audible sigh, mumbles something to the effect of "rivered again," and throws his cards into the muck. We take down the $320 pot and now have 406 to our name. Until next time, I'm Malcolm O'Malley, reminding you that No Limit Texas Hold'em is not for the faint of heart. I'll see you on the film.
All right, well, you know, I'll admit I see the logic in firing the third barrel here. But in general, I think it's good to remember to avoid playing out of position. And no matter how we slice it here, this river bet was a gamble. We won this time. Next time, I don't think we can be so sure.
Yeah, I agree. And I always hate being in a spot where I can't win unless I bet, especially when it's the river. I don't know. I don't know if I could have summoned the courage to bet here with this guy as a calling station. He could be slow playing and Hollywooding. I said it likely he wasn't Hollywooding, but there's just so many factors here that we don't know that I think I still stand by my first assessment that he probably had a middling pair. And I know I probably can't bet a win without betting. But I don't think I have the courage to bet again because it's getting big now. Now the pot's a decent size. You're going to have to bet like 125, 150. And yeah, I don't know if I really want to do that, bet 50% of my stack on
that's
a
ballsy 125 bet on O'Malley's part. And, like I said, a one.
And like you said, he started with, 300? So
yeah, it's a lot of money to put in with ace high.
Yeah, yeah.
Big kicker.
Yep. So I don't think I could have done it either.
Well, you know, I keep going back to the great advice that the Lee Childs give us. You know, in tournaments, you have to be creative. In cash games, you don't have to, particularly a 1-2.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is just a situation where, you know, if you're really competitive, you want to win every pot and try to get as much money out of every pot as you can. And I don't begrudge anybody doing that. But, you know, a lot of us just aren't to the level where we can really think this on these seventh or eighth levels in these 1-2 games. And to me, I just would avoid trying to get out of position. I would just play in position and make my money that way. And I think we just got ourselves caught in a situation here. We made the right pre-flop decision. We made the right flop decision. And then after that, I probably would have just shut down and hoped to catch my ace or my 10, to be honest, at that point, or 5 or something. And we didn't get it. So to me, you're not going to see me firing that third barrel, probably not even see me firing the second barrel, but then again, that's probably why I'm probably easy to take money from.
Well, I guess the final thought here is he did say rivered again, so I'm assuming he did have something like sixes or eights.
Right.
You know, because what else, if he's telling the truth, what else could he have? He's not going to be rivered by, you know, a set's not going to get beat, so he must have had something like that, I think, and I think it could have been tens, who knows?
Yeah, and you know, and that comment, too, actually, you know, gives you some credence to firing that third barrel, too, you know?
Yeah. And especially
because obviously
fans.
The guys believe in you that he probably put you exactly, almost exactly what you had. I mean, a big ace. Obviously, we didn't have the king, but that's what he put us on, and thought we were just pushing him around, and then boom, you're sitting there when you have that pair. You're like, please don't put a overpair on the board. I mean, a big card on the board. And when they do, you think about your own hand. You don't think about what they have. And turned out to be effective. So what do I know?
It's a good good move there by O'Malley.
This Johnny Chant. You listening to Ante Up? Let's Play Poker.
Ever since we were introduced to Chinese poker, we've talked about dedicating a show to this great game, Chris, haven't we?
Oh, absolutely. And it's literally been like 4 years in the making because we either find other things to talk about or we just don't know where to go with it. But this is a perfect opportunity, I think.
Well, yeah, certainly after today's guest contacted us, we decided now has to be the time. Steve Pogatch and Mark Rubin from Smapsoft are the creators of the Chinese 13-card poker, an app for the iPhone, iPad, iPod, Touch. Company just recently released version 2.1 of the app, which adds a host of new features for players to use in trading wits with fellow Chinese poker fanatics like us. And as we mentioned at the top of the show, Ante Up PokerCast listeners will have a chance each week to win a free download. Thanks for joining us today, guys.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
All right, well, we definitely want to spend plenty of time talking about this very cool app that I know Chris has been spending all of his time playing, and I'm envious because I have not upgraded to the future and the iPhone, but someday I will. We want to start off by telling people just exactly how the game is and how it's played, Chris. So do you want to get us started with that?
Yeah, sure. And the traditional and most popular version of this game, you generally try to play with four total players, and so four hands of 13 cards are dealt out from a standard deck. The object is to set three poker hands. The top hand is a three-card hand, and then there are two five-card hands below that, and they're in ascending rank. So the top hand, the three-card hand, has to be the weakest hand of all three hands, with the middle card, five-card hand, weaker than the bottom five-card hand, but stronger than the top three-card hand. And it's pretty simple. You're playing just basic poker. You're just trying to set poker hands and make them better as you go down the ladder. And it sounds simple. but once you start to play it, you really see how challenging it can be when you're faced with whether to split up hands or will the king high that you put on top, because your hand is so weak, will it still be strong enough to maybe get you a point and not get scooped? That kind of thing. So there's a lot of nuances to the game, but it really is simple in its basic structure.
Yeah, and I think the nuances are what make this game a lot of fun. After everybody sets their hands, the cards are turned over, and you compare your three hands individually with the three hands of all your opponents. So if it's you and me and Faso and Gambit playing, I'll compare my three hands to yours first,
right,
and then to Faso, and then to Gambit. And for each of your hands that's better than your opponent's, you earn 1 point. And you can play for fun, obviously, which most people like to do, and just keep track of points. Or if you want to play for money, you can assign a monetary value to each point, whether it's a dollar, a dime, or a Skittle, or whatever you want to play with.
The game has a number of variations, and some of the fun, too, is coming up with things that you could do differently with the game. A few of the most popular things include surrendering, which means that you can forfeit your entire hand before you set it, and then just pay them 2 points because you just knew that you were going to get scooped for four and end up losing a ton of money. So you can just say surrender and give them 2 points each. There's also royalties, which I really don't play a lot when I'm playing for real money because it's crazy sometimes.
It's really expensive.
But I do play it on the game, and I can't wait to talk about the game soon. You get additional points when you play royalties if you set like certain hands, like straight flushes or four of a kind or maybe three of a kind on top, that kind of thing. If you can actually set a hand that way, you'll get paid for that. Or you also get a royalty for sweeping all three hands. You'll get an extra point sometimes or whatever you decide to put it on. Other things, too, Scott and I like to do this. We like to make the middle hand, instead of a high hand, we like to make it deuce to seven low ball, which is really puts a real twist into the game. All of these things add a little spice to an already spicy game. You can Google Chinese poker to learn more details about the variations, but, there's not a lot out there. I think if somebody wrote a Chinese poker, even if it was like a Cliff Notes book, I think that would sell well, but...
Probably would. Well, you know, you can play live in the biggest California rooms. You know, when Chris and I went out there to September, we sat and watched a little bit. It's really interesting to see it actually being played live.
Yeah.
And some major tournaments do actually have Chinese poker events. But for the most of us, it's a great game to play shorthanded or in cramped quarters, like on a plane, or when you don't have the time to play the traditional poker games. And to me, that's why I think this Chinese 13-card poker app is such a welcome addition. I played with a friend on the way down to the Dominican last year, about a year ago. We played all the way down because it's easy on the plane. You just you play it on the phone, and you pass it over to each other. And,
yeah.
You know, makes it really easy. So let's start chatting a little bit more about this app. And Steve, get us started here. Tell us a little bit about the app's development and why you guys decided to create it.
Sure. Mark and I had been, we still are, we've been poker enthusiasts for a long time, and we had a home game where one of the players came and showed us this game he played while he was a kid with his family. We would play it, you know, while we're waiting for people to arrive to the game, or, you know, during those lonely bust-out times where you're sitting in the corner just waiting for something to happen, you know. So these little Chinese games would break out, you know, the little corners of the room or corners of the table. And I remember when we first learned, it was interesting, we'd synchronously see three chips floating over to this guy every few minutes. He'd say, hey, let's buy him for $10, you know, and then, oh, sure, you know, it'll last a while. But, you know, the first few games I played with him, the chips were just flying his way. So I'm like, oh, this is a really interesting game. At that time, everyone, you know, including us, had started to get all these gadgets, iPads, iPhones, iPod Touches. And Mark and I decided we needed to make a Chinese poker app. You know, not only for people to just learn the game, but also to play against friends. We felt that a big part of this app would be the multiplayer aspect, and bringing in, you know, other iPads and iPhones and iPod Touches is a big element. And for those people who didn't have iPhones, sorry to one of you guys. we built in the pass and play element, so two people or three people can share a device together.
Now, how long did this process take, and what were some of the hurdles that you had to clear?
I'd say initially building the app took, you know, under 2 months or so. And Mark, feel free to chime in if you need to. But yeah, we spent a lot of time testing it and fine-tuning it. And what I mean by that is trying all sorts of combinations, like you have an iPod Touch, I have an iPhone, she has an iPad, and someone else has an older iPhone. Let's mate them all together and play it and see what works. And so trying all different scenarios and combinations of that was pretty rigorous, but the testing is so important. Also trying many different scenarios where one player would drop out and disconnect. You know, we were mixing pass and play players with Bluetooth players. So a lot of that took, you know, a fair amount of time to get right before we released it. What's that saying, Mark? It takes 80% of time on the last 20% of development.
Yeah, definitely. Especially with a network game, because there's so many factors that are really out of our control as developers. We have to really do a lot of testing and make sure it's rock solid before we send it out in the wild.
I remember on our last cruise that I was on, two of our staff members were playing it, and they were playing it on their own iPads and going back and forth, and it was really quick and really, you know, it's flawless. That's the best part about this app is there's no mistakes with it, and it's so easy to read your hands. I liken it to online poker. You know, when I play Stud 8 or whatever, I love to play online because you can see all the cards. And the same with this, you know, if you got to hold them all in your hand and then put them in, but this app, which we'll talk about, you know, you can literally just touch a button and it puts them all in rank for you, or you could touch the suit button and it puts them all in suits, and they're all right within your vision, and there's no struggling with the cards or dealing, and it's really quite awesome.
No missed deals.
Yeah, exactly.
And you figure out the points correctly too, which is always fun when you're playing live. Did I pay you? No, did I? No, I think I paid you. No. You owe me two. All right. I think I owe you three.
You owe me lunch.
All right, so you guys just introduced version 2.0 and then 2.1, added a host of new features, including Twitter bragging and things like that, that make the game more enjoyable. Why don't you tell us a little bit about some of the new stuff?
Sure, I'll give you the rundown. We take user feedback pretty seriously, and one popular request was for online play, you know, in addition to Bluetooth. I remember during the summer, we would start to hear about a lot of people using this at World Series of Poker tournament tables. I have a couple dealer friends there, and they said, "Hey, we see your app out there in the wild." And I was starting to see little people, some pros twittering about the app and whatnot. But, you know, being able to play across the Amazon room with Bluetooth is probably not an easy thing. That's not the only reason, but we had a lot of requests for online play, so we felt we needed to do a major revision. So we added online play through Apple's Game Center. It makes so much easier for users to connect with one another across the world, you know, or play with a random opponent with the auto match feature we put in there as well. Like the first week this went live was really exciting for me. Really exciting for me to play with someone from Australia in the first few days after this came out. So that was pretty cool.
I can't speak from experience with that. I was playing one night by myself. It was probably after midnight. And all of a sudden, boom, on my screen comes like a request or whatever. And I'm playing a guy in Michigan.
Cool.
And he's like, "Hey, how's it going? You know, we're talking and we're comparing what poker games we play, you know, standard poker games we play and where we play and all. So we're having this little talk while we're playing." And one time I set my hand and I'm waiting and I'm like, "Oh, he must have lost a connection." So I chatted at him, and that's another great thing to have, that you can chat with them to see if they're still around or not in case there is some sort of lost connection. You know, with other things, you can't do that. You're just playing and hoping the other person's there. So I said, "Hey, did you give up?" And then a couple minutes later, he's like, "No, I'm at work. Hold on." It's like he was playing me while he was at work, which I thought was great. But yeah, I've had experience with the the Game Center and stuff, and it's really opened up a lot of things for a lot of games on these iPads and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. And you know, I liken the chat feature a little bit to the online poker, which we're all kind of jonesing for these days, unless you want to move to Canada. But I won't go there. well, you know, in addition to adding the Game Center, it also opened up a new road for us to add achievements. So that adds extra value to the solo play. You know, I mean, I'm still fighting to try and get that Dragon Hand. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. Actually,
that's one achievement I'll probably never see. But it's funny because with the 2.1 update, we added Twitter. And most I like to comb Twitter now and then looking for Chinese poker. And recently I saw someone posted one of their hands. It was a natural that had 13 unique cards. I've never seen that before in live play or on the game. So that was pretty exciting to actually see someone post that. So yeah, back to that. In the 2.0 update, we had the chat, and we also added another level of AI, which I'll let Mark touch upon in a few minutes. But the online chat, and we also did some graphic and user interface enhancements, kind of revamped the front-end menu a little bit. But the 2.1 update, which came out pretty recently, we added Twitter integration throughout the app. On the front page, you can now tweet your Game Center ID, and you can also tweet in general about the app, which is pretty cool. But one thing I like a lot, and this may help a lot of these pros who I saw prior to this update tweeting their hands, is the... You can now, on the showdown screen, at any point during the showdown, tweet your hand, which makes it's real easy. If you have a Twitter account in your phone or your iPad or iPod Touch, you just hit that Twitter button after showing down some cards, and it'll just tweet your a screenshot of your hand right up there, which I like to call Twitter bragging, you know. So,
I know that when I played the computer, I had, not me, the computer had a natural 13 unique ranks or whatever.
Oh, really?
Yeah, the computer had that against me just a couple of nights ago. So I've definitely seen it. I've never gotten it. I've gotten quite a few things, but the dragon and the natural obviously have eluded me. It's pretty crazy.
Yeah, that's
pretty rare.
Yeah, very rare. So yeah, bringing the social aspect to this is, you know, also another thing we've been trying to do. We also just recently created a Facebook page for the app where people can also go and post their Game Center ID and also try and get games going to, you know, or discuss strategy, which is, you know, good right here as well.
Yeah, speaking of that, let's kind of morph a little bit. We'll continue to talk about the app, but we're going to talk a bit more about the strategy as well, too. So, Mark, you're the one that developed the artificial intelligence for the app.
Right.
How complicated was that, and obviously how important is it for solo players to have good AI?
Yeah, I mean, it's absolutely critical for the solo players. As Steve mentioned, we actually rolled out a brand new, completely built from scratch, new AI in version 2.0. And the main reason for that was that the original version was okay, you know, especially for beginners. But as players got better, it was just too easy for them to beat. Hmm. So this new version is a whole new approach that is actually pretty challenging. The way it works, it's kind of interesting, is once the 13 cards are dealt out, it actually goes through every possible unique combination of those 13 cards and assigns a score to that combination based on the probability that those hands are going to win in the showdown. And then, of course, it just picks out the top score, and that it puts out. So it's pretty strong. You know, maybe it can't beat every expert, but it's pretty good, I think. I think it can give pretty much anyone a run for their money.
Well, I have to say that I played one game, I played 600 hands at least, and it was 101-99. And I was in the lead, and I've gotten it up to like 140 or 150 where I was leading, and then it comes all the way back. It always comes back. I mean, no matter what I do, I can't keep the lead.
Well, that's kind of the nature of the game. You know?
Yeah.
If everyone is equally balanced, then over time it should just come out. If they play correctly, it should just come out exactly even, because it's just the random fluctuations of the cards at that point.
Yeah, that's pretty much exactly it. You know, I feel like, oh, I've got a good run of cards here, and that's why I'm leading. And that's why I always kind of steered clear of playing Chinese poker against guys that play all the time, because I always feel like, you know, there's a lot of luck, but if they have any skill and luck, I'm going to get crushed. So I don't play that often, but I like to play when we're on the cruise, just because, you know, it's something to do when we're waiting for a table to start or something. And But yeah, I did notice that the computer really is tough. Now, I don't understand, though. Was it like an algorithm you wrote yourself? How did you do this?
I wrote the algorithm.
Wow.
So I wrote the algorithm to run through the hands and figure out what all the different weightings are. And then we used some statistical data from a book that's actually been published by a guy named Dan Smolin. It's just called Chinese Poker. So in there, he's got tables of the statistical probabilities of these various hands coming up and winning. So we started with those and did our own tweaks, you know, for playability, and have implemented that into our own algorithm for doing all the calculations.
So now, in your research, have you come up with like some of the common mistakes that beginning players will make when they set their hands? Are there things that you said, hey, look, these guys are doing this, let's set the computer to make sure it never does that? Or what are some of the things you've come across?
So without a doubt, the biggest mistake I think that beginners make is forgetting that all of the hands are equally valued when it comes to the showdown. So the front hands are worth just as much as the back hands because they're only playing against the other hands on the same street.
Right.
So what they'll always do, beginners will always do, from what I've seen, is try to overload the back hand, the strong hand, and they'll put a monster in the back end. And just completely forget about the front hand. You know, they'll have, you know, jack eye in the front, but they have to get that full house in the back.
Right.
Sometimes that works, you know, but a lot of times it doesn't, and over time it won't. It's always better to have the three strongest hands, even if any one of them isn't as strong as it could be.
Well, one of the things that I notice in the game is that it almost always strives to have a pair on the front hand. I mean, it's incredible how many pairs are put up there. And I'm like, oh, I had a pair again. I had ace-king. You know, it's remarkable how it seems like it's sacrificing the middle hand almost to get that pair on top and then put a big hole hand on the bottom.
Yeah, if the back hand is strong, then it makes sense to do that.
Yeah.
If you have a weaker back hand, then of course you want to make sure that your middle hand is strong as well as your front hand.
See, this is great stuff. This is great stuff, man.
Well, you know, I kind of want to play a little bit off what you mentioned, Chris, before that last question, too. On this last cruise, we actually introduced Chinese to a couple of folks that never played it before. And their reaction was, like a lot of people is, when they start playing, hey, this is kind of cool, but it doesn't seem like it seems like we're just trading chips back and forth. No one ever really gets ahead. And I think one of the things I noticed is that there is a very small margin here where the really good players can take advantage. This is not a game where you're going to hammer somebody. Generally, it's really knowing those small little edges and pushing them to the max. Is that what you guys have seen as well?
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, a very small difference in skill level over time will make a difference. But it's true over the short term, the swings very much more depend on what cards you get, and that's kind of why the gamblers like it, right? Because there are these very wide swings.
Right. Yeah.
Well, the gamblers probably like the royalties as well too. Well, one of the other things too that that I first learned in playing the game is just like in football, you have to have a good defense. Sometimes you break up a decent middle hand to have a better shot at winning on top and avoiding being scooped. I'll admit I haven't read a lot of strategy, but is that a good idea?
It's a great idea. Yeah, it's a great idea. It goes back to what I was saying before. It's a lot of times you can make one monster hand, but then your other two hands are terrible and you get scooped and you come up behind. So a lot of times it will make absolute sense to break up that monster hand to make three good hands.
I have two questions now. One was, well, actually, one of the things that I wanted to say about strategy was I noticed, too, like I just said about the computer where it likes to put a pair on top and almost sacrifice the middle. In playing this game, you have to play it like poker as well and know what the player habits are. If I'm playing Scott and I know Scott likes to put a pair on top or never puts a pair on top, then I think I can get away with putting a pair of deuces up there to win that point and then load my backhand. So always remember that. But I also noticed, too, that surrendering is a big thing, and that's part of that defense that Scott mentioned. You know, if you just know that the best thing you have is four pairs and you can't make a flush or a straight, playing three other guys, you need to surrender that hand.
Right, right.
And then also keep in mind the royalties, too. You know, if you think you can set your hand that you can make a three of a kind on top, you know, if you're playing royalties the way the computer plays them, or if you know you have six pairs or whatever it is, the computer gives you royalties for, like, six pairs, all cards under face cards and aces, obviously, and then also for like three of a kind on top or a full house in the middle. So if you're going to play in a game with royalties, then you might want to take those into consideration when you're setting your hands too. There's a lot to consider playing. It's not just make three poker hands, you know? But my question was, when we watch poker on TV and we read books and stuff, they always bring up the computer hand. They say Queen 7 is the average winning or average starting hand or whatever it is for poker. Is there something like that you've come across in your tables and in your AI and everything, that what's the average winning hand on top, middle, and bottom?
The average winning hand. You know, I haven't seen that number, no.
Okay.
But that's a really interesting point. Just from my own experience, you know, some of the hands in a regular poker game that are a fairly strong hand don't translate into a strong hand in this game. For example, in Hold'em, a straight is a pretty solid hand.
Yeah.
But you put a straight in the back in Chinese poker, and often that's actually not very strong at all.
Right.
So there really is an adjustment from playing standard poker to this. But it's actually an interesting point. I don't have those numbers, but it would be kind of interesting to do a study on that.
Especially when you're playing heads up, because I did some research a long time ago, and I remember somebody saying that ace-king on top is a pretty strong setting. And so when you're thinking that, if I'm playing heads up and I know the average hand put up there is ace jack, then I know I might be able to keep that king for the straight in the middle or something and put a queen up there instead, you know what I mean, or something along those lines. And I just wondered if there was average winning for each spot.
I don't know those numbers, but I'm sure, of course, they're out there. Yeah, interesting. Yeah, with the ace-king, I think is really strong, because a lot of people, if they get an ace, if they have a spare ace, of course they're going to put it into the front as a high card.
Sure.
So if you can get that king or a queen as well, then you knock out all those other people who are doing exactly that.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of pipping in this game, I think. You know, where you put that, as Chris said, you put the, oh, I think ace-queen will be good, and put it up at top, and then somebody has ace-king, and then on the bottom, you know, you have a, all right, oh, my queen high straight will be good, and then somebody ends up with a king high straight, and that's where the game goes from fun to frustrating, I think, sometimes. All right, well, I know you guys are going to stick around here and help us with a special Chinese poker edition of Hand of the Week, correct?
Sure.
Excellent. Before we move on to that, though, just remind us where they can find this great app.
So it's available on the iTunes App Store. You can find it either by doing a search on Chinese 13-card poker or just Chinese poker. It'll come up there as well. Or you can search on our name, Smapsoft, S-M-A-P-P-S-O-F-T. Or you can go to our website at www.smapsoft.com, or we're on Twitter at Smapsoft or Facebook or all over the place.
Very cool.
Yeah, you guys really should work on finding more places for people to get in touch with you.
Yeah, that's right.
All right, let's move on to the Hand of the Week. All right, so we already know that most of our listeners are commuters, and they kind of flip out when we throw a stud hand at them because there's too much to write down. So we'll apologize in advance, but we'll go slowly here. It might be a good hand when you get back home and you can actually write down the cards to write them down and think about them. But what I did for this is I went ahead and dealt out four hands from one deck, and I kind of looked at them all and tried to look for ones that I thought had some variations where people might play them a little differently. So we'll see whether I picked out a good hand or not. But these are the cards that we have available to us. Diamonds, we have the king, 8, 7, 5, 4, and deuce. The spades, we have king, 5, 4. Clubs, we have queen and an 8. And hearts, we have a 4 and a tray. And I sent these all to Stephen Mark earlier, and Chris obviously had it before too. And I think what we decided is we were going to try to set our hands, and then hopefully there's some variation here. But if not, at least we can talk about what some of the thought process went into how we set our hands. So does anybody feel very confident in their hand that they want to brag with starting us out here?
I'm pretty confident.
Wow, yeah, of course the AI guy speaks up.
Wait, let him go last.
I'm fine, since it's our show, I'm fine going first and getting bombarded if you want. What I did was I had to have something that I thought could win the middle and bottom, and not because it's a rookie thing, but because I felt like King Queen 8 might be strong enough to win the top, so I went with King of Spades, Queen of Clubs, 8 of Clubs on top. And then I put 3-4s in the middle, thinking that people might do pair, or whatever, and then a full house. It might not, you know what I mean? So I may get them to break it up or not. I'm not. So I went with 3-4s in the middle with the 3 of Hearts and the 5 of Spades, and then the King High Flush, King 8, 7, 5, 4. Or no, King 8, 5, 7, Deuce.
So what was your top hand again?
Top hand was King Queen 8.
King, Queen, 8, okay.
And then I had 3 of a kind in the middle, hoping to beat the 2 pairs and hoping that my flush might be big enough. It depends. If somebody throws a full house down there, then I think I might have them on top if they throw 2 pair in the middle. So that's why it was my thinking. If they threw 2 pair in the middle and only queen high on top, then I've got them for those 2, and I may lose with the flush. But if they go with pair, and 2 pair, or something of that nature, whatever it is, then I might, or pair, and 3 of a kind, or whatever, then I win the middle and the bottom. So that was why I went that way.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm. Okay.
Interesting.
All right, I'll go next, and then we'll let the experts brutalize this here. I think I got 2 points out of you, buddy.
Okay.
On the top, I put the 8s with the queen. In the middle hand, I put the kings with the 7 deuce tray. And then I put the boat on the bottom with the 4s and the 5s.
Yeah,
that's exactly what I did.
Yeah.
Chris sucks at this game.
Hey, Scott, you know what? Friday night, I'll play you as much as you want.
Yeah, give me your game center ID.
Yeah.
Well, I guess my thought process, and I guess you guys did the same one too. So I initially, one of the things I guess we didn't talk about in the strategy, but I always ask Chinese poker players when they play, how do you guys start setting your hand? Do you do it by rank first, and then suits, or do you do suits and ranks? Obviously, on the app, it's really easy because you can push a button and see them both pretty quickly. But in this particular situation, I mean, you've got the cards and stuff. So do you guys have a preference on how you start?
It's funny because when I got this hand, I actually grabbed a real deck of cards and dealt it out for myself. And I felt like that little kid in that viral video who was reading a magazine but doing it like an iPad. It was like shot to my system because I'm so used to hitting the suits and rank sort button. So what I usually start out by by sorting by suits and see what I have. So when I originally dealt this hand, I'm like, oh, I got all, you know, fluttery from all the diamonds. Right. I'm like, oh, look at a flush. And then I saw the fours, and I heard Obi-Wan going, use the fours. So I'm putting the full house in the back, a pair of kings in the middle, and a pair of eights up top with a queen kicker. So that's what I ended up doing, just to distribute it as evenly as possible.
Yeah, I guess my thinking
is... You did the same as what we did?
Pretty much, yeah. But I just wanted to tell what I did as well.
So, so I always look for first are three of a kinds. So yeah, I always go to the... I look at the ranks first, see the three of a kinds, and then I switch over and see what suits are there, see if there's any flushes. And then I usually go back and... If there's a full house, I'll usually try to build something around the full house. That's just kind of my style. So I'll start with that and just see what it gives me for the rest of the hands. And if there is something for the rest, then I'll usually go that way. If there's nothing, then I'll think about breaking up the full house.
Yeah, I used to do flushes first. You know, not flushes, the suits first. And then when Scott and I were playing with Gavin Smith that time, Scott was like, you suits or ranks? And he's like, ranks, of course. And I'm like, and Scott's like, see, I told you. And I was like, all right. And it's true. I mean, once you build that full house, sometimes I don't even have to look at suits. Because once you see that, you know what's left. You know what the best thing is. The only thing is with this game, I hit the suits button just in case there's a straight flush in there that I'm missing.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah.
You know what I mean? But other than that, once you build, like, when Scott gave me this, I did put the full house first. And I was trying to think outside the box because I knew there's four of us playing the same hand. If I was playing heads up against somebody, I would probably put the full house at the bottom, and then I may have put two pair in the middle and gone still with something else on top or whatever. But
I thought about putting the two pair in the middle as well, and the reason I didn't was because that left me with just a queen high in the front, which is kind of weak.
Right.
So I decided I would sacrifice the mid a little bit and throw the eights up there.
And that's why I think I went wrong, because I thought, well, a king high isn't as weak as queen high, so why don't I put the three of a kind in the middle and go with a flush on the bottom instead of the full house? Because that's the other thing, too, is, you know, if you're playing legitimately three other hands, you know, people may still be doing the two pair in the middle on their normal hand. You know, we compared the same hands with each other,
right,
but
yeah,
against other hands, you know. So that was my thinking, was playing against other hands rather than what we're all going to do with the same hand.
Yeah, I was going to say, I do want to clarify for our listeners that are new to this game that when you play, you all have your own individual 13 cards out of the deck. Now there's obviously, you can think about what you have in your hand and know that they're obviously not in somebody else's hand. So this particular situation was a little unique in the fact that we're all playing the same cards. And so you could tell that, you know, if you did, as Chris said, put the flush there, if you did what we did and put the boat in the bottom, that somebody might be able to put the trips in the middle, so two pair in the middle wouldn't be good. But in general, I mean, you don't have that benefit of knowing everybody's cards.
Right. But that was a lot of fun, because I wondered if what I was doing was going to be, like, laughed at or whatever, because I just wanted to try something to think that maybe someone would go with like, queen high on top and two pair in the middle. And then instead the full house on the bottom, because then I thought I would catch you guys with just the bottom board, but it didn't work out that way.
Well, I don't think it's anything to laugh at. I mean, I think this is one of those things that, this is what makes this game really cool, in my opinion, is that, you know, you've got this thing where you've got particular players, I think, that don't like to concede at all. They like to try to win at all. And I think setting it the way you did is one of those ways where you're kind of going for broke there. You're like, you know, hey, a king high flush is going to win a good amount of time on the bottom. You know, trips is not super strong in the middle, but it's a decent hand. And then king high every once in a while can swing it. So you're swinging for the fences there. And then I think that you have other folks, obviously, Mark and Steve, your first time on the show, but I'm a little bit more of the conservative one in the group here. I'm willing to sacrifice in this game, so I generally just try not to get scooped, and if I can win two out of the three, I'm happy. And so that's why I know the kings are never going to win in that middle, or almost never, I should say. Sometimes you get shot in this game.
Another
but I figured the eights would be good at the top, and a boat is really strong in the bottom. So
yeah, another way to go with the flush in the back would be to use the eight high flush. So you keep the kings in the middle. And move the, let me see.
The fours
at diamonds to the middle to get two pair there. You're still stuck with the queen in the front, which isn't so great.
Yeah, that's why I didn't do it, because that makes it really weak. It's only an eight high flush, and then only two pair in the middle when I had a king high flush and three of a kind in the middle.
Yep.
And just an eight, a queen on top. So that was why I shifted around that way.
Yep.
And but that's the other thing, too, is just because you think you got it, always look back at your hand, because I mean I saw the full house first, and I thought, well, that I said Scott put that full house in here because he thought it would be an easy snag, and so let me look at this hand again, and he actually got me in reverse. I thought he was putting it in there so that I would put it there and it'd be the right thing to do, and instead he got me for 2 points by screwing my head.
I'll admit, Chris, I mean, I didn't think about that at all, but when I first looked at this hand, the first thing I did, I had the king high flush on the bottom, and that's where I started with, because I'm one of those folks that, it's funny that you mentioned that when we were playing with Gavin that I said ranks first, because maybe I've switched since then, but I'm definitely a suit first person now. I like to see what my flush possibilities are, and then I go for ranks. So when I first did it out, I'm like, oh, great, I've got six diamonds, that's great. And I like the six diamonds because I know I've got a flush, and then I can move around some of the cards in it.
Yeah.
To work with something else. I mean, it's much better than when you have a five card flush and you're locked into it, and then you know it doesn't give you much maneuverability. But yeah, I think that's interesting. I started out with the flush at the bottom and worked backwards, and you did the opposite.
So now you guys came up with. Now I have to admit, I don't, like I said before, I don't play royalties very often. But are the ones that you guys have standard? Because I don't remember ever somebody saying to me when we were playing, oh, look at that, you would have had all 13 cards under, under no face cards, or, hey, look at that, six pairs, you get royalties for that. I don't remember anybody saying that when we did play royalties in the short period that I did. I thought it was just high hands. So are those standard?
You know, there's no official set of rules. You talk to a bunch of different people, and you get, you know, you talk to 10 different people, you get 12 different answers on what the standard itself should be. So what we tried to do was just to, first of all, put in as many as we could come up with, because we thought that made the game more interesting to play, and then come up with sort of an average value for all of them. Some people, you know, say royalties are only worth a couple of chips. Some people say royalties are worth, you know, 20 chips or whatever. So we tried to come up with something in between.
Okay.
But we didn't invent any of those. Every single one of them was something we had heard from someone at some point.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, again, that's one of the great things about this game is there's so much variation you can do, and you can sit around, and depending on how many beers you have, then I come up with six more variations that you're going to forget the next day. So, well, I really appreciate you guys coming on. I'm real excited that our listeners are going to get a chance to win this app every week, and hopefully a bunch of them will go out and buy it and download it so we can all start playing from the Antiup Nation. Once again, Steve and Mark. One more time, just remind us the name of the app and where they can get it.
Called China's 13 Card Poker. It's available on the iTunes App Store or through the App Store app on your iPhone or iPad, or www.smapsoft.com.
Thanks, guys.
Hey, thanks for having us.
All right, talk to you soon. I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Long.
We'll see you at the tables.
Any Up is a production of AnnieUpMagazine.com and is recorded at WDAE 620 AM in Tampa. Contact us at podcast@AnnieUpMagazine.com or call our hotline at 813-448-1120. If you'd like to advertise, send us an email at advertising@AnnieUpMagazine.com or call 727-331-4335.
Some music used in this episode comes courtesy of the PodSafe Music Network.